Welcome to the seventh talk in the series. As I mentioned last week, we're going to forego the discussions between the talks and just have the rest of the classes be the remaining talks. So next week, I'm going to be gone, but every time I'm here from now until the end of this series, there'll be a talk regarding the next picture of the ox herding. And so we're on the seventh phase of the ox herding, and maybe I can just preference what the ox herding pictures are. The ox herding pictures are a depiction in image and in word of the transformation that occurs as somebody engages in the spiritual path. And it starts out in kind of desperation, as most of us do, feeling a tremendous sense of inspiration and perhaps alignment with what is being said, but having no idea whatever as to how to uncover that so that we have any access to it. So there is a somewhat frenetic early on activity in which we try to discover our path and try to make it meaningful so that we in fact can move towards the spiritual, whatever way we define that. Well, it turns out that the spiritual is intrinsic to our being, and each of these pictures begin to show how, as we further move into the effortful practice of uncovering the spiritual, we begin to realize that fact, that it's not something to chase after, it's something to relax into. It's not something to effort our way towards, it's something that is much more available than we had originally realized. And one way to depict that particular adventure is by the ox herder chasing the ox, which is his own nature. And so at first the ox herder feels very much empowered as himself or herself to discover that ox until he or she understands that it's their effortful ways that are somehow obscuring the very inward nature of their spiritual life. And so slowly and very quite likely begrudgingly, we have to give up our strategies and our efforts and be transformed into the ox. So the series of pictures are that process. And number seven, I'd like to read each one before the talk. And number seven says this. This talk is called The Ox Forgotten. The Ox Forgotten. Astride the ox, I reach home. I am serene. The ox, too, can rest. The dawn has come. In blissful repose within my thatched dwelling, I have abandoned the whip and ropes. So it's that point where there is the complete redefinition of who one is and what one must do in order to uncover the spiritual. That he says in this particular caption, he has abandoned the whip and the rope. He's no longer struggling with his original nature. In fact, how could you struggle with something that's in him intrinsically there already? Doesn't make any sense. But until we know that, paradoxically, we have to struggle for it, which is what we've been doing. That's what all this practice and turmoil has been about. So you're not doing anything wrong. It's just that it's not a complete picture. It's not a complete unfolding of the understanding of what this whole tradition is about. What's helpful and is to understand the what we do and how we do it is very carefully defined to not take us away from the ox, but to bring us into the ox. So tonight, after this preamble, I'm going to talk about how the practice is meant to do just that. I want to get very specific. I want to get very practical rather than theoretical or abstract, very pragmatic. What are we doing that takes us through these ox herding pictures? What are they? What is it meant to do? And are we allowing ourselves to be to move in the direction that the practice is intended to take us, so that we can actually see our intrinsic nature? Or are we fighting our intrinsic nature, and thereby diabolically, perhaps not the right word, confusing the whole picture? So we need to look at the practice, and I'm going to just outline every set of instructions and how that set of instructions has the intention to take us to our intrinsic nature. And then you are to ask, hopefully, whether you are using those instructions for that purpose or for its counter or counterproductively. Okay? So it takes honesty, as all these things do, to do just that. But first, let's talk a little bit about the ox forgotten. What could that possibly mean, forgetting the ox? I don't know about you, but when I first got involved in this, it was an aha experience of some amount of energy and enthusiasm. And for a long period of time, I was on kind of a high, having finally uncovered what I think I had known for some period of time, but it had been given words and a direction. And I thought, oh boy, you know, but it felt very much like there was this great adventure I was getting involved in, with a lot of different experiences and ups and downs, and kind of like going into a haunted house. And just I knew things were going to pop out at me, but I was willing and ready, and I was very enthusiastic to do just that. Well, after a number of years, or perhaps decades, being a slow learner, a stubborn learner, I should say, it began not to be so dramatic. I had gone through just about everything the mind could do to me, and then some. And not just once, but many times. And it was no big deal. In fact, I couldn't figure out what the big deal was about the spiritual journey at all. In fact, even to call something ordinary spiritual seemed to be misleading. That it just, spirituality defined everything. It didn't define a certain type of exercise or a certain type of effort or a certain type of will or a certain type of practice. It was virtually everything that occurs. How could anything not be spiritual is another way of saying it. And so it was just this. It was the mundane. It was the ordinary. It was the typical and the usual. And yes, I could go on retreat and develop some of the sublime, allured qualities of mind, but I didn't at some point feel that that was necessary any longer. And I might as well deal with my more gross forms and manifestations, my reactions, as well as anything. But there just didn't seem to be a spiritual path anymore. At one point it seemed very laid out, very practice-oriented, technique and method directed and driven. But at another point in the maturation, it just seemed like getting out of bed in the morning and going to sleep at night. There was just nothing unusual or typical about it at all. And I think it's at this point that the ox is forgotten. That the ox, that sense of nobility within the journey, and the sense of specialness that we sometimes feel as we evolve through the journey, just really, we transcend that back to the usual and the ordinary. And much of what we have done, we've discovered, has been running from the ordinary. And more subtle ways, we have been avoiding the typical, because nobody that I know of likes to be thought of as being normal, as just being typical, as being usual, as being ordinary. No, we all want to be special in some way. And there's nothing more specialized than the spiritual pursuit. So I think we hold on to that image and to that definition of what we are doing in order to give us a sort of a self-enhanced boost. So that even though it looks like we're doing nothing on our mat, sitting there like a lump on the log, a bump on the log, whatever, some part of the log, we're not really doing anything at all, although we like to claim reference to it. And we carve out a certain part of the day to do it and all of that. That is not in any way to undermine the fact that we need to do it. That it's important for us to do it. But it's just being ordinary. You're sitting down being ordinary. Will you give me that? So let's just get on with that. What's all the hyperbole? That we don't need the bells and whistles here. It's like, what's in front of our eyes and what's manifesting here? So suddenly it's no longer the haunted house that we love moving into with the ghosts popping out and scaring us. It's the house of mirrors that we've entered because we realize that every experience represents us, our face, coming back at us. And it's that we have to square ourselves with. Because the reflection says too. But if we release the reaction that creates the reflection, it doesn't say too any longer. It says empty. It says one. It says ox and herder abide together. So the ox forgot. Nothing special. I love that. You know, it's extraordinarily profound to understand that and not lose any intentionality. In fact, it only enhances one's sense of focus and intention. And in so doing, the other thing that I want to just mention before we get into the layers of the practice is that so much of what compels and propels us as human beings is this sense of needing our lives to be useful. Useful in some kind of often dramatic way. We want to leave some monument of ourselves back to the world. And self-transformation is a great monument to have. And this usefulness gets the self very engaged. I see impermanence, it says. I see how I've been following the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain. Now I will set and align myself to the right direction in the right way. And that nobility of purpose that we can take on as we listen to the Dharma, as we become enthusiastically Dharma driven, as we start reframing all of our life in terms of the Dharma. And that makes us feel very useful and very noble. But it's also very self-compelling. It also brings the sense of me out because we feel like the self has to have a reason for being. And the better reason to be is to have a noble cause at hand. And may I say that there's nothing noble. It's not noble or ignoble? What's the opposite? Ignoble. It's neither. It's just seeing things the way they are. It's just seeing what is really there. It's like we were out on a journey in our car and we hadn't been paying attention to the road signs, and somebody starts talking to us about how the road signs will take us to where we really want to go. So then we start paying attention to the signs and we drive to where we want to go. Are now we more noble because we paid attention to the signs? Not really. Because I just want to sort of take off the specialness about what we're doing. But not to the point where we can become dismayed, because that's where the self would love to go, break out of this hole that the spiritual journey has. It's not to get dismayed and say, oh, geez, I might as well just go back and be nothing but me. No, this isn't going back to be nothing but you. But neither should we put a coating of glimmer and glamour on it. Neither should we feel as if this is something better than what my neighbor is doing who's not involved in this at all. It's just simply living in the direction of wisdom. Finding the signs that direct us in the right direction to life. And not judging those who are not on this journey. So I just think that's an important, to make the ox forgotten, we really have to see through the specialness that we have created around finding the ox in the first place. So, let us look now at the practice, and I want to take the practice apart and just show how this practice is meant to take us to what's authentically and intrinsically and naturally our own. Now, we can use it in a counterproductive way. And again, as we go through each of these instructions, I will give you an explanation as to how these instructions point us in a correct direction, but each of us have to reflect upon whether we're using those instructions within wise view or unwise view, a sense of connectedness or a sense of disconnection. That diversion of going and using the practice for disconnection, for self-enhancement, is always, always there. It will be there until we die. It's what the Buddha said when he says, okay, Mara, I see you now. You're seen, Mara. This is in Buddhahood. He was still seeing Mara. Certainly, in whatever level of understanding we have, we're going to see Mara. Mara being the mind wanting to reform itself around me. So the practice is a perfect development of that. It can be towards our advantage or towards our disadvantage. But generally, if we give our practice over to connection denies using it for too long in an unwise direction. Because you're connecting. And once you connect with oneself or with whatever the experience is, then we're faced with the mirror image of what we're bringing to accentuate, to reinforce, or to react to that mirror image. And then we can see whether we're disconnecting by being aversive to that, or we're trying to grasp it and prolong it, or we're just seeing it for what it is and letting it be. And once we get the cues down, we'll know immediately whether we're using life in a wise direction or an unwise direction. As long as we stay within the field of, or the definition of, connecting as the basis of what all practice is about. When we start feeling disconnected, when we start feeling exclusive, more select, more special, which is why the preamble, then we're moving in a disconnected way. I'm doing this and you're not is a disconnection. I'm special and you're not. We're all, always and forever, ordinarily ourselves. Always. In fact, in Zen, they talk about the stink of enlightenment, because people who do awaken often awaken. It's like the balloon of self gets very big. It doesn't burst. And then they walk around with a kind of arrogance of what they've seen and no one else has, or no one they know has. And they say sometimes that that takes 10 years for the stink of enlightenment to leave. But in any case, it takes some time for us to... But just being humble, just being ordinary, saying, is this a disconnected? Am I connected in this moment or disconnected? Just that frame of reference keeps us moving straight towards the heart of the teaching. Everyone can ask themselves that. What's my relationship to this experience is another way of saying it. Okay, so let's look at this practice. I call it the practice of just being. Just being. Just being. The practice of just being. You see, now if we're going to find what's intrinsically ours, we don't really need to do much to do that. I mean, we just want to know, to have manifest what's authentic. And we keep losing our way, thinking, because we feel so inauthentic when we don't do anything, we think, well, I must do something about this inauthenticity in order to be authentically myself. So we keep trying to overcome ourselves by our inauthentic self by the pretension of being authentic. Which doesn't make any sense at all, does it? It doesn't make any sense at all. So why don't you just wait out the inauthentic? Doesn't that make more sense? I'm just going to wait through this thing. This seems like, if it's a joke, if it's inauthentic, it's not going to last, is it? Something inauthentic is just a facade. So I can't take it too seriously. And if I just wait through it, now waiting through it doesn't mean not paying attention, because it's our inattention that creates the inauthenticity. So I have to pay attention, but waiting patiently, waiting is a little, waiting it out means patient, being patient with it, and just being aware of it so that the awareness no longer, the lack of attention, the lack of awareness no longer feeds the inauthenticity by having me react to what's inauthentic. You see? When I feel the anger, then I react to being angry and I start throwing things. It's just the inauthentic exaggerating upon itself, leading to more profound inauthentic behavior. But if I'm willing to just wait it out. And I waiting it out doesn't mean wait. It means being patient, patience. So that the patience then, with awareness, says, okay, so this is just the momentary display of conditioning that I have learned that's, it's not authentic. And let me just say, no emotion is authentic. No thought is authentic. Where does that leave us? Not with much, does it? Doesn't leave us with much. We keep giving authenticity to our thinking, to our emotions. But this is the intuitive me that senses what you're really like. Yeah. If you really saw what the person was like, you would see the ordinary. You would see out of your eyes, through your eyes, the ordinary eyes. So what we see of the world says a lot about the way we are looking at the world. Okay, so the practice. So this practice of just being, that's what the practice is supposed to engender. Engender, again, makes it sound like it's something we're engendering, but that's taking us away from just being. Okay, so what do we need to do to just be? Well, not too much. First thing I need to do is to relax. Wouldn't that make sense? So just look at it pragmatically and practically. I mean, if you're going to come and listen to me, you have to give me some validity. So even if you don't know this yourself, you're just going to have to trust me that I'm not lying. That you're as authentic as the Buddha, each of you, each of us. And so when everything else, all the conditioning, all of our reactivity, all of our hair pulling, tension, all of that has been an add-on. Okay, so the first thing I need to do is to find what's authentic within me, that just being state, is to relax. And lo and behold, the first thing we say to anyone when they're learning to meditate is relax. We don't have any idea what that means because there's so much tension that we just skim the surface of the penetrating depth of where that word can take us. It means psychically releasing, not resisting. But we'll deal with maybe just softening up our neck muscle, which is okay. It's a little better than what we started with. But we could just move with the very word relaxation to the depth of enlightenment if we wanted. You can take these words and they just plummet right on down to the center of the earth. Relax. Release. Don't try to accomplish something. Now we give you a task, and unfortunately that's the rub. Because it's not relaxation and loss of attention. It's relaxation within attention, within awareness. But our minds have not been trained to pay attention. So we say relax and pay attention. And that seems like an oxymoron, because when I try to pay attention, I'm not relaxed. I can't pay attention. And so now the self really gets engaged and thinks of itself, now it has a task in front of it. I've got to pay attention. It's forgotten all about relaxation. Hears it off in the background somewhere. But now it's really got something it can bite its teeth in. Relaxation doesn't do much for it. Relax is what you do on vacations, not what you do when you really want something to get done. And so we go with the effortful training. And fair enough, because there is effort required, and I don't know how else to frame this thing, because we can't do it, or at least I haven't seen it done, or rarely seen it done, and it certainly isn't the Buddha's path, where we haven't stabilized our attention sufficiently so that we know where we are unrelaxed. I mean, how do you know where you're not relaxed? You have to be aware of where you're not relaxed. Nothing happens in this whole unfolding of practice unconsciously. It doesn't happen. It happens through conscious attention. And most of us haven't learned how to pay conscious attention, which is a training, partially. And so now I have to learn how to pay conscious attention. And then all of this beautiful and sublime qualities of mind come forth from my ability to pay attention, and I feel calm and serene, and I feel all this just... Then the self says to itself, wow, I'm on to something now, and I'm moving in the right direction. Just keep up the force and effort, and get more of it. And that isn't authentic anymore. What we wanted to do was to find out how to relax. But the self has taken the bit and started running with it, forming new areas of manifestation, of improvement, of enhancement, and can go a long time in that direction before it's called back. Relax. Relax. Ease and receptivity. Now remember, we're moving into just being. Just being must be authentic. Just being. Okay. So, to be, I see something happening here in the practice. Is that the practice instructions keep telling me to receive what's going on. Don't lean into what's going on. Don't try to force what's going on. Just be present with what's going on. The words hold the intention to receive life, not to form around it, not to create something from our efforts, but just to receive it. Receive what's going on. And that sense of ease and well-being that comes from the receptivity. The willingness to pause. You can't think of anything harder to do in your life than to pause. It's like taking a domino out. There's just nothing that riles the mind like taking a domino out of its day. That's why it finds no time to sit, no time to appreciate, no time to really listen, no time to actually take in and understand anything. It's too interested in forming, compulsively forming life out of itself. Because that's how life becomes meaningful, is in its formation. I can then see quantifiably what I have created. Just relaxing, listening, receiving, understanding doesn't hold a great deal of useful ventures for the self. But that's where the practice is taking us. And it is through those words, listen carefully, that I can connect. Remembering that the direction of this practice is towards greater connection. How am I going to connect with something, first of all, unless I'm conscious with it, to it, of it, or listen to it, or receive it? There's connection. But the mind tries to produce, and in its production, it's not connecting with anything. It's just doing what it thinks it needs to do to connect. Never realizing that connection is not forward bending, it's open ending. We don't lean in to connection. Connection doesn't require. It requires us being affected by life, of opening up enough so that we can receive what life is already there, so that we can meet life, right? There's nothing, we don't need to lean into life in order to meet it. Life is happening. What's keeping us from acknowledging that? That's a better question, I would think. So this relaxing with the breath also cultivates calmness of mind and gentleness of being. And this is very important, this ability to relax with the breath, to invite calm into the breath. Yes, these states of mind can be productions of themselves, but they also arise very naturally in the course of just being present with the breath. And what we find is that when we don't make them an end in themselves, but allow them to arise on their own, we find that they actually make connecting easier. It's easier to connect with life when we are calm than when we are distracted or frenetic or worrisome or impatient. See, the words allow connection. But if you make the words the end, they don't connect you with anything. I've got to be more patient. I've got to be more calm. Do you see? Okay. So if we just allow the words to arise as byproducts to receiving life, what they do is they begin to break loose, loosen up the hardness of heart. Because hardness prevents fluidity, flexibility, insight. Nothing can be seen. It's a disconnection. Hardness is just ambition. It's compulsion. But it's not being affected. It's not being connected. So we have to develop these words, allow these words to develop on their own, and through these words, we will find a greater sense of interconnectedness. Now, what I often suggest is that when the mind loses its focus, gets lost in thought, that especially early on, that people first go to the sense of relaxation rather than to try to get right back to the breath. Getting right back to the breath is being self-driven. It's being compulsion. It's making it into a forced task rather than into Just relax and let the breath find you. Just relax and the breath will find you. It's not going to go anywhere. Where's it going to go? We don't have to hunt it down like a bloodhound. Where's it going to go? So just relax. Dissipate the attitude that formed in our inability to sustain our attention on the breath. And if you're a task-centered person, which many of you are, you're going to find a hardened attitude and self-recrimination coming up when you're not able to stay on task. And instead of carrying that back into the breath, all the self-judgment, just dissipate it with relaxation. And let the breath find you. If it doesn't find me, it's not worth seeing because, I don't know, it's not around. It's only that which is around that is worth seeing. There's the breath. I'll be darned. See, we're taking ourselves out of production, off the assembly line. Because once you understand that the strategies of self are to keep assembling yourself into a better and better package, and that the heart demands just the opposite, and that if you're going to walk this in an authentic way, we have to walk this into emptiness, into releasing the tensions of self, into the authentic being of what we already are. And so we relearn to receive experiences. We can, if we go the direction that thought takes us, direction takes us into a compelling forward movement, doesn't it? Thought, when you start thinking it, you're out driving somewhere. It feels like you're out right driving your car or something, right? But receiving experience is a very different sense. It's a very different visceral sense of a connection to life. We're not driving our car through life. We've stopped the car. We're outside and we're just like this. Stopped. Quiet. Quiet. And we begin to get a sense of the value of life being lived outside of the noise of thinking. And that's the great turnaround through this array of pictures, that great turnaround where, I can enjoy the ox. I can enjoy being authentic much more than I could ever enjoy being a person. Isn't that interesting? You think, you have such enjoyment from our status and from our name recognition. But what is that? What is that? I mean, if I think highly of you, what does that do for you? For me to have thoughts about you, how does that help you? Doesn't. Like you're untouched by thought. It's just self-embellishment, really. The whole world could love me. What difference does it make? It doesn't make a bit of difference. Especially if there isn't self-love in here. If there is self-love in here and the whole world doesn't like me, then it doesn't make any difference that way either. But we have to see that. And so we begin to appreciate the quiet and serenity and wholeness of heart that comes in with just being simply ourselves. Just being simply connected. And it builds upon itself. It gets better and better the more we relax the need to perform within the experience. By performance, I mean do something with the experience. Fix it, move it, shave it, enamor it, brag about it. When we don't do anything with the experience, it gets better and better and better and better and better. The ox forgotten. It gets better because we get more normal. Just being. It's an active state, not a passive state. It's a live state. And what we begin to do is understand the more we receive, the more we're affected, the more we allow ourselves to be touched, the more we understand the harmlessness of all things, we let down our guard, and lo and behold, we're relaxed even more deeply. We're not full of tension about this implicating, my mind implicating me somehow. It's like, so what? So what? How's that hurt anybody? And the other thing that happens is that when we just examine things by receiving them and understanding them and seeing them, space grows, space. They're not so confined within our fear. The relationship isn't so dramatically corridored. It's spacious. It's open. Awareness has come in. Presence. And we're predominantly with things, the instructions say, without judgment. Why? Because in judgment we're being selective. We're deciding what should live and what should die. And that frame of mind is built in such inward tension that it can't relax. And so this sense of non-judgmental awareness. Oh yeah, I remember when the teacher said that, like day one. Non-judgmental awareness. Trust. That my judgments don't determine my paranoia. If I don't have knowledge about you so that I can react and run away from you when you come into the scene, what am I going to trust? How can I develop trust? Awareness itself, the discerning power of awareness itself is what I begin to trust, not my intellect or my judgment. And then fourth, the instructions go to choiceless awareness. Choiceless. So that the awareness is expanded now beyond the need to objectify one part of the mind and to keep moving like monkey bars from one predominant sensation to another. There is a time when that's useful, and then there's a time when you let go of the monkey bars and you free fall. In Zen, that's called shikantaza, just sitting, just being. Just being authentic. Natural state. Nothing, everything is just the way it is. Nothing is made special, predominant, unusual, abnormal, just ordinary. And may I say where the ox is forgotten? And this will stretch some of us. The difference between awareness and being aware of. When I am being aware of, that is me initiating awareness and contact, defining what it is that I'm being aware of. And when I'm aware of, there is someone being aware. Those two are mutually dependent upon one another. Now that's different than awareness. See, this is just the final step of releasing the ox, letting the ox be forgotten. Just awareness. 360. No one being aware. In fact, it doesn't even feel like it's being contrived by anyone. But if I, what does it mean? I am consciously being aware of. No, that's your interpretation of the mechanism. It needs further relaxation so that it throws the sense of self in the middle of awareness itself rather than the sense of self stimulating a mindful attention. Just for the moment. Feel awareness outside of you, outside of your skin, holding the experience called me, but in no way being limited by that experience. Or even confined or defined by it. Now the ox is truly forgotten. This is the practice. We grow out of ourself. We grow through ourself. Let's know this. Let's set our course and intention and not be fooled any longer. Thank you all. Can we just sit for a moment or two? So my attempt is to make this ox herding pictures as pragmatic and useful as possible. Maybe I have betrayed that in the earlier frames, but I want to bring it back now. That this is not beyond reach. This is not something that is many centuries or decades away from us. But we have to know where we're going, and we have to get a sense of the pitfalls and obstacles that lie between ourselves and the path, because they are considerable. There's no question, they are considerable. So if there are any questions or comments tonight, I'd be happy to try to respond. Yes?
At the end, you were talking about awareness becoming impersonalized.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And, but there's nothing that we can do to make that come about. It's just something that will gradually happen as we go through.
Very good question. The question has to do with the impersonal quality of awareness, and it has to do with her statement that says there's nothing we can do to make that happen, and that it'll just come about. Yes and no. And I don't mean to play this in any kind of avoidance way, but we have to see, one thing we have to do is see that there's nothing we can do. That, I'm not playing a game. We have to know irreversibly, irrevocably, that any attempt to do something reframes the problem so that it's now we're at the we're going in the opposite direction. And we will each come to that moment when that is understood. Until then, we're still trying, which is fair enough. It's just part of the unfolding of the ox herding. We realize that there's nothing you can do about anything. That everything has its own perfection in its manifestation, even forgetfulness. So that we don't even try to wake ourselves up from forgetfulness. When we attempt, through effort, to wake ourselves up from forgetfulness, I'm kicking you way out there now, okay? But I want to do this. I want to, like, cast it way out. But I don't want you to stop trying to wake yourself up unless you have seen this. But at some point you see that the effort to wake yourself up actually creates the conditioning for you to fall asleep. And when that's seen, then there is no more falling asleep. And when that's understood, then virtually everything that is manifested manifests perfectly in exactly the right way, including everything that's happened and always has happened within us. And that this thing has always been on autopilot. And that the movement and momentum of life is towards waking itself up. Because there's not two. And we have just interfered with that waking up and every step of the way. Isn't that absolutely the cosmic joke of it all? However, most of us don't understand that. And for us to then move in to say, okay, I'm not going to wake up. Fine, you'll be asleep. Period. You see, the thing wakes itself up from our understanding what is happening, not from our going 10 steps up and saying, oh, I see what the high school kids do, being 6th grade. And I'm just going to pretend like I'm a high schooler. You can't do that. You got to go through all the grades, and then you graduate. All right, so this sense of awareness being self-manufactured is one of those grades where we are mindfully trying to maintain awareness and keep calling ourselves back into awareness, and it really feels like this is all of a product of me. This is my spiritual waking. This is me. Everything is around my efforts to make it happen. So that's a very, it's a very limited understanding of what's actually occurring, because the sense of you trying to make it happen actually shuts the shutter down. But we think it actually opens the shutter up. So it's all backward. We find the door through relaxation. Because relaxation doesn't do anything, but it feels like it's something I can do. See, I can try to relax. That's great. Do it that way. The best thing you can do is to relax. Because for you, it's a doing, but it's actually not a doing. So it fools you. Okay, I'll relax. Great. I can do that. Okay, relax. Relax deeper. Relax deeper. Okay. Actually, you're opening your hand. You're not squeezing it tighter. Right? And that actually is the way the practice works. So, if you want to do something, The best you can do, the least destructive and least distorting thing you can do is to release, to surrender, to relax. And you'll find, and this will confirm that it's the right way, when you relax, you're connected. You're present. It was the tension. See, this is important because you'll figure it out. As dull as we are, we'll figure out that the tension held the presence at bay. Because when we relax, good Lord, we relax into presence. Now, what does that mean? That means when I'm tense, I can't be present. So I begin to go, duh. All right, so I've got it now. You see? So now we just start moving. So any effort, any tension to do something with myself actually obscures what's authentically there. When you see that, and you will. But you've got to work it in the right direction. The quicker you wake up to this thing and work it in the right direction, the faster it will go. If you want it to go fast, some of you don't want it to go fast, and so you'll go on to other, you know, other practices that allow you to struggle. That's true. That's true. Yes?
I have a question. When you said that emotions aren't real, I guess my question is, so just so I get some clarity, does that mean that we can have a physical sensation in the body of something, and we call it some emotion?
Yes.
If we just stay with the physical sensation, then the idea that I'm sad or the idea that I'm lonely or
right.
whatever goes away.
Yes, but you want to include the mental state as well. It's not just physical sensation. There's a mental state to the emotion. But what I meant when I said that emotions are not personal, they aren't true, is that we don't take the emotion for what it is. We take the story about it to be true. And so it's not the truth of the emotion to us is what it tells us about the world, which is the story we add to it. And that isn't true. The physical sensation is true. The state of mind, the feeling or emotional tone in the state of mind, it's true because it's happening. What we conjure up, the way we hold and project, the way we storytell around it, it has nothing to do with anything. Right? And so, but we take it to be true. So, to unwind, you see, each of those holds attention. When we are living an untruth, which is living a thought or living an emotion, there has to be attention in order to maintain that untruth, you see? Like when you tell a lie, there's a kind of tension in telling a lie, isn't it? Well, that's the same way is where the tension builds is when we confiscate the truth according to our projection. That requires a kind of energetic resistance from letting the truth in. In order to hold our minds in a particular direction, you have to screen out all the information that says this is untrue. And that tension is ultimately the psychic tension that we are eliminating when I talk about relaxation. See? So. Yes. You have to speak up a little.
Oh, sorry. When you say that,
she says, is that when I'm talking about emotions, it's just being what... You see, the way the sense of self forms is by identifying with some aspect or expression of life. And therefore, when it identifies, when it makes itself real around some aspect of life, it has to tell a story to keep that aspect of life alive to it. The first story we tell is I, my, me, mine. That connects us to that experience or expression of life in a very personal way. Now that it's personal, we elaborate upon that personal and say, you have done this or that, or make a whole time element about it, right? The event itself didn't hold time, and it didn't hold I, me, or mine. We brought that to the experience and invested the experience with that, right? So when we don't do that anymore, the thing starts getting vague. The sense of self doesn't form in the same way. So where does the energy from that investment go? It goes back to life itself, boundaryless life. Or presence. Okay. Thank you all very much.